Today's program has been brought to you by Roberta's Pizza, robertaspizza.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Happy Sunday. Welcome to the main course. My name is not Patrick Martins.
What?
My name is Philip Gilmore, sitting in for Patrick Martins indefinitely. Not in the studio is Alexis McLaughlin, which last time I talked to her, she was in Alcatraz, literally.
Wow.
In studio, we have Jack Inslee.
Airhorn.
And Odetta Hartman. Jack, as you may or may not know, is the executive producer for all of the Heritage Radio shows. So, welcome to the studio as a guest.
Thank you so much. You might know me from... This show has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, wholefoodsmarket.com.
Ooh, I recognize that voice.
That's me.
So, how are you guys doing on the Super Bowl Sunday?
Oh, it's Super Bowl today. That's right.
It's also Jack's birthday.
When is your exact birthday? It was on Saturday.
It was on Saturday.
Nice, yeah. Nice.
Oh, first of all, thanks for having us on the show. It's really nice to be a guest.
Awesome. Yeah, what are your plans today?
I'm judging a soup takedown with you.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we are judging a soup takedown with Maddie Timms. It's going to be at Lilyfield, I believe.
I guess so.
In Gowanus. Yeah.
Awesome.
So, how are you guys doing?
Recovering. Long weekend.
Long weekend, yes.
We had the best meal of our lives at Momo Sushi Shack on Saturday night.
Oh, it was so good to see you guys.
It was damn good.
What did you eat?
Oh, man. What didn't we eat? I kept remembering later, like, oh, the uni.
Right. Yeah, the uni's.
And then there was, I think, Fluke from Long Island.
Fluke from Long Island. The uni was from Hokkaido, north of Japan. Mm. The best uni
that
in the world.
That was the best uni I've ever had.
That's the best,
You made me try uni.
Aw.
And that now I have a taste for it.
Nice.
But I don't eat meat, so the salmon pastrami was really exciting for me because I'd never tasted anything like that
before.
Yeah.
I loved the, we cured some salmon, some wild salmon, and we just did a very traditional pastrami cure, but I loved it because you could actually taste like the cloves and the, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a good restaurant, everybody, if you haven't been.
tell me a little bit about the history of Heritage Radio, Jack.
Yeah, let's see if we can consolidate this into a quick story. So around 2009, Patrick Martins had this incredible idea, and at that time it was kind of like the website idea on a napkin sort of thing. And mm-hmm. I remember meeting with the Spotted Pig with my buddy Nat Wiener, a.k.a. RecTech, who was doing work at WNYU, like doing program directing and stuff there. So Patrick got in touch with NYU, who recommended Nat, and Nat came to me and said, dude, I need a guy to do this with me, you know?
Yeah.
So we came on.
What year is this?
2009. So Nat did most of the work up front originally, like getting a lot of the equipment in here, and a lot of the stuff was like our cables from home. Mm-hmm. That, you know, like we just made it happen on a tight budget. And
the inception happened after Roberta's opened, right after
Roberta's
opened.
Yeah, yeah. So Patrick had a relationship with them, and he was like, so, guys, what do you think about shipping containers / like I already ordered them? Can we just do this?
You know? Do you know I was working here at the time?
At Roberta's?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I worked here for a few months when they first
So do you there. Remember the build out?
Uh-huh. I actually
like
remember
Les and Chris and Brandon and Patrick.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. There's still some caulk here that you could see on the wrong side.
Watch your language. This is a family program.
So. yeah. So, yeah, that's when I came on kind of helping Nat out because he was the main studio guy. And then in the following like month or two, I became more of a lead producer and kind of took on most of the shows in terms of like supporting the hosts and engineering it all. And
how many radio shows did it start with?
Probably like three originally, like two. Well, there was the Farm Report and the Main Course / the News Hour with Patrick Martins, and I think those were the first two. And then slowly Zach Palacio had a show, Sarah Obritis had a show.
Mm-hmm. I remember Sarah coming in here.
Beat to the Beat. And then Erica Wides came. Snacky Tunes was somewhere in there in the beginning. I mean, now we're at 40.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
I tell people 70, but... I'm like, you know Heritage Radio, and they have like 70 shows.
Yeah, a day.
And I'm on the I'm the host of the main course.
Which is like 50 of them.
Yeah.
So in 2012, Aaron Fairbanks came on when we became an official nonprofit. So before then, it was really just, for a while, myself and Patrick doing mostly everything. And then we became a nonprofit, which like totally changed the game. Mm-hmm. And then Aaron came in as the executive director and turned it into like a real organization, like a legit, you know.
Do you have any favorite guests or any? Do you have like a favorite story? Somebody like an idol that you always wanted to meet, or like, you know, or somebody that came in here drunk, or that was
Andrew W.K.
funny.
Would not leave.
I heard this.
He came here. We ordered him a car. He came here, and then he was like, "So what's up? Are we hanging?" Like it was like 12:30, 1.
Yeah,
and we're like, "I'm just like, I really want to go." But
he loves to party.
He actually does, though.
He literally loves to party.
He really does. I thought it was an act, and then he was. Well, I won't say on air, but it's not an act at all. But Moby, when he came in early on, this must have been like 2010 on Snacky Tunes. Moby came in, brought the acoustic guitar. He sang Lou Reed. We all sang along with him.
Aww.
And at the time, that was like the biggest guest we had.
Yeah.
So that's a cool moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know. I got to meet Sirio in here.
That's
from Le Cirque. That was kind of, he's like, well, you know, like not only the restaurant, but the fact that he's probably the greatest host and maitre d' ever. You know, I got
like
to,
the first.
I got to hang out with him, but then I got to, you know, he has, you know, kind of he walks with a cane, and he's, you know, kind of, you know, he's an older gentleman. But I got to walk him out to the street, and he was holding my arm, and I was just kind of like shitting my pants, you know.
I just finished editing his life story that we recorded here.
Yeah,
which was unreal. I mean, a guy that age, he like can't really keep thoughts for too long, so it was pretty scattered. But hearing it all put together is really nice, man. It's an incredible story. He came down here on a cruise ship, working 20-hour days for no money, and then he just comes to New York with not enough money for a cab, finds his way to Delmonico's.
Yeah.
It was insane.
I don't know if you guys saw it, but if you get a chance at the HBO documentary about him,
A Table of Heaven?
It's unbelievable. Like, I don't think that people really realize, you know, because at the time it was considered maybe the best restaurant in the world, but, like... They had like 20, you know, 20 seats, and it was tiny. And, you know, when somebody came in, you'd have to move the table out, you know, and put it back. But it's just like to give you an idea of how exclusive this restaurant was, like Reagan, you know, of course, has his, you know, inauguration dinner at the White House. The next night he had dinner at Le Cirque. Like it was that, like, you know, like it was that big of a deal. But also too, like, I don't know if it was from, I think it was the movie, but, you know, there's this quote where somebody said, that when you went into Le Cirque, you came to, you know, you would see Sirio, and then you knew that he didn't know who you are, and he acted like he did know who you are, and he made you feel like the most important person in the world, but it didn't come off as disingenuous. Like, if you made it to the restaurant and you were in front of him, he would make you feel like you were the, you know, the Prince of Morocco or something, you know. So.
And then he's probably also seating the Prince of Morocco.
Exactly, and he would also make that person. But also, too, it doesn't come off as disingenuous. It doesn't come off as a con or a scam. And I really, you know.
It's a fine line, right?
You know, when I'm working, you know, even before Momo, you know, sometimes I, you know, come in contact with 500 people or 600 people a week, and it's like people are paying money for this experience, not only the food, but the experience of eating at a restaurant. So it's like, I want people to feel special. So I kind of like, you know, took a page out of his book, literally, to kind of use that as my kind of like motto, you know, my model for service.
He told this awesome story. I don't remember the third person. It was Jack Unassis, Frank Sinatra, and there was one other person.
I'm pretty sure it was Eddie Vedder.
it was like maybe Monroe or something too, but they all had the same table that they liked to sit at. And like when he first started at Colony, not the other place, you know, he like took reservations from all of them, and he's like, shit, I triple booked this table with three. What am I going to do?
Yeah.
So he called them, and he did first come, first serve.
Really?
And then I think, who was it that showed up first?
Sinatra.
I think it was Sinatra. And then he became really good friends with Sinatra.
Wow.
Yeah. He's a legend.
Frank Sinatra, he's an interesting character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what? I think I'm allowed to tell this story. I've never told this story before. Do you want, like, a well, I've told it to a few people, but, you know, it's something that's kind of special to me. You want to hear a great Frank Sinatra story?
Okay, please.
So I was working at a restaurant in Palm Beach called the Poinciana Club, and it was it was kind of revamped. It used to be a theater and dinner club for, like, rich people to go to. So you go see a show, and then, you know, you have dinner afterwards. So they kind of, like, they kind of revived it, and I was working there the first season they were open. It was like, you know, pay $5,000 a year just to eat there. So and the outfits were ridiculous. It looked like you were, like, cruise ship, like, all white, and, you know, the captains had the, like, little orange stripes on their shoulders. And so I'm taking the bus to Palm Beach, and there was this older, probably about 80-year-old gentleman, African-American gentleman, sitting at the bus stop with me. And he says to me, he's like, you know, where are you going dressed all fancy like that? And I was like, I work at the Poinciana Club in Palm Beach. And the bus was coming, and he's like, please don't get on the bus. And he grabs my arm, and he says, I have to tell you something. And he was getting emotional, and I was like, Jesus, I was already late for work. So I was like, okay, I'm going to say. So he tells me this story that he was working at the Poinciana Club in the late 50s, and he was a waiter there, and, you know, of course, you know, the whole staff was African American, and the manager asked him to come in on a Sunday to work brunch, and they weren't open for brunch, but it was Frank Sinatra was going to perform, and what happened? Okay, so Frank Sinatra was going to perform, so they asked him to come in and wait on him for brunch, just him and his band. It was like 10 people, so, and at the time he's like 18 years old, so he. How does the story go? He basically is serving them breakfast, and it's, you know, it's like 11 o'clock in the morning. Frank Sinatra's hungover, and he gives, like, Frank Sinatra, you know, eggs over medium, and Frank Sinatra, you know, grabs his arm and says, "Boy," he's like, "I want it over easy," and he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Sinatra." Just says, he's like, and he starts yelling at him, and so, you know, and he calls, and then he says, you know, he's like, "Sir, don't talk to me like this. You know, I'm not even supposed to be here, and I'm just, you know, doing my manager a favor." And so you know, they got in a fight, and so he took off his bow tie and walked out.
Okay? Wow.
And, you know, this is like in the, like, you know, early 50s or something, and so, you know, he walks out. He's afraid he's going to, like, you know, he doesn't know what's going to happen. He just lost his job and, you know, just freaking out. So Monday morning, the manager calls him and says, "Can you come in?" And he thinks he's going to get, like, you know, beat up or arrested or something. He comes in the manager's office, and the manager said Frank Sinatra wanted to apologize for his behavior. And he personally pulled me aside to make sure that you kept your job. And he left this, and it's an envelope with $5,000 in it. And it says, "You have heart, kid." So the reason he got emotional, this is when he's working at the Poinciana Club. You will not find this online. You will not find this in a book. This is from this man. The house he bought a house with $5,000. He bought a little, you know, house, and he never paid rent and never paid a mortgage for his entire life. His wife had just passed away the year before, and he just sold the house for $800,000 that day.
Whoa.
Yeah, with the $5,000 that Frank Sinatra gave him. Frank Sinatra, wow. Touching people's lives.
Wow.
In good ways and in bad ways.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that great? It's a very special story to me. I don't really go around talking about it. But
I'm glad we got that story out here.
Yeah.
That's a good story.
Well, you know, there's the other side of Frank Sinatra. You know the joke that Dean Martin tells? He's like, "Frank Sinatra saved my life one time." Do you know this joke? So Dean Martin says, "Frank Sinatra saved my life one time. I did a show, and then I went back out on the island and was smoking a cigarette, and these three, like, Italian thugs come up and start beating the hell out of me and kicking me in the face and kicking me in the stomach." And so Frank Sinatra comes up, and he's like, "Okay, that's enough, boys." So,
wow.
Yeah. Waiting Frank. Tables in Palm Beach. Good times.
That's incredible that you were waiting tables in Palm Beach, though.
Not really.
It is. You've got. I bet you've never really told your whole story. Well, you told your story on Gunwash, I guess. You did. We got a little bit of it.
I probably left out about
99%. Yeah. There's many stories. I hope you seep them out throughout the season of the main course.
Oh yeah.
Every week, just a little new.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we'll do a retrospective, the best of Philip Gilmore's life.
Then we'll edit it together. Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well. That's nice.
So you grew up in Long Island, is that correct?
I did.
Strong Island?
I did. I don't like saying it, but I did.
Why?
I don't know. you know, I always wanted to leave. Even like as early as 13, I was like, when I'm the day I'm 18, I'm out of here. I'm never coming back.
Yeah.
You know,
I said that about Florida. But...
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's the suburbs. There's not much there in Long Island. I mean, there could be more in Long Island. Yeah. But where I'm from, West Babylon, is like real suburban.
Oh, shit. I didn't know you were from West Babylon.
West Babylon.
I thought you were from like Montauk.
No,
Hamptons.
No. That's the thing. People hear Long Island and they like, yeah. They're like, oh, so you're from like the Hamptons? I'm like, yeah. No, West Babylon. We go back to visit, and there's not one restaurant. I always thought to myself, like, you know, if all else fails, I could open a restaurant in West Babylon, and it would just be.
I am amazed. Like, even in Montauk and even the Hamptons, which, you know, I don't hang out there a lot, but the times that I've been there, I'm amazed. The food's not good.
No, it's not. Yeah. People like their, like, you know, the food they like out there. They're not very open-minded.
Yeah.
But, you know, thankfully not there anymore. I've been in the city now for over 10 years, I guess, 11 years. Yeah.
You are officially a New Yorker.
Right, is that it? It's 10 years?
I don't know.
Well, Odetta here was born and raised in New York. So now, I used to tell people when I meet them, like, where are you from? Like, New York, Long Island. But I can't say that around her.
Sure you can.
No.
So you were born in the Lower East Side. Without divulging your age, can you tell me what year you were born? Nobody do math.
1989.
Wow.
Just made it.
Wow. The first time I was in the Lower East Side, I think it was 1991, actually. Yeah. I came up here and went to Webster Hall. They used to have a thing called Psychedelic Thursdays.
Nice.
Yeah. So, maybe it was 92, actually, yeah.
Odetta's family kind of, like, made the East Village into what it was in some ways. Yeah. Like, Two Boots was the first family place. Is it okay to say that? Odetta's family started Two Boots?
Yeah.
And the Great Jones?
Yeah, that was first. The Great Jones. Have you been there? The Great Jones Cafe?
No, I know of it, but I
didn't. You should
go.
It's really great. Yeah, it's pretty much the same as it was in the mid-80s. And they didn't have money to print menus, so they just painted everything on the wall.
Wow.
And, like... My dad's shot glasses are still there in the jukebox.
Oh, my God, that's amazing. And your family still owns it?
No, they sold it a while back, but to friends, and it's exactly the same.
How many Two Boots are there?
More than I can count right now. More than 10.
More than 10,
and it's national. There's two in L.A., one in Baltimore, one in Nashville.
Awesome.
And my dad's always, you know... He got flown to India. Somebody wanted to do one there. Yeah,
wow.
That's not happening. But he got a free trip out of that. That's cool. And yeah, actually, Florida. He was just there. But I don't know if that's going to happen either.
Wow.
But,
well, there's enough. There's you'd be surprised. There's like I grew up with more New Yorkers in South Florida than I did Floridians.
There seems to be a Roberta's Florida connection also. I feel like half the staff is
from Florida.
Shipped up from there.
Isn't this weird though? So I actually, you know, obviously I do radio and it's at Roberta's, so there's pizza involved and I do radio. Odetta for work comes from a pizza family and teaches radio at the Lower East Side Girls Club to young girls.
You found your soulmate.
Pizza radio. I'm like,
too funny.
What are the chances? Yeah. How is that? How's that been? It's awesome. You're teaching kids how to make
radio,
right?
Tell us a little bit about that. Yeah.
It's so great. The Lower East Side Girls Club has been around since the 90s, and they just operated out of one storefront forever. Mm-hmm. And then in the summer, I believe, they moved into this ridiculous facility on Avenue D that has a planetarium, a real one, and an art studio, and my little room has an Airstream, like a vintage Airstream from 1956, Silver Bullet, that's totally been outfitted with an engineering board, surround sound, microphones, everything. And so I teach classes 3 times a week, teach your girls how to make beats and how to do interviews and podcasts and sound effects. And it's really cool because a lot of them are like, they live right across the street in the projects on Avenue D, and they just are so excited to come in and express and create. And I'm really excited to see what happens. We're just kind of getting the basic skills down.
I know what Jack's thinking. He's saying an Airstream must be nice.
Yeah, it is weird. Shipping containers here, Airstream there, the similarities.
That's kind of a cool radio station.
Yeah.
Airstream, that's awesome.
It's very nice.
It's very sleek.
I don't know if you know or what, if it's public information, but how does that happen? How do you go from like a storefront to planetariums and Airstreams? Did somebody die and leave them $1 billion or something?
No,
or?
But they do have... you know, they have cool friends.
Yeah, that's basically, yeah, that's just from benefactors.
Yeah, there's a lot of donors. I'm not trying to blow up anybody's spot, but I think it's public knowledge. Like, Tom Petty's daughter is a good friend, and she produces videos for us and hangs out. George Harrison's son came through one day.
He's awesome. Actually, you know Greg from Death Killers?
Yeah, yeah.
I was hanging out with guy, you know, Murder Bar with Greg, and he showed me this video. It was actually, we got in this really big conversation about Prince, but it was the... I don't know what it was. It was a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction or something. But they were, Prince was playing the guitar solo for Why My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Oh, for Harrison, yeah.
Yeah. It was for Harrison. But his George Harrison's son was playing guitar, and he was just like watching Prince just with his jaw drop. But he seems like such a... And he's like, there's no mistaking, that's George Harrison's son.
George Harrison's son is on a song with Ghostface Killah and Raekwon somewhere.
Really?
He like played a guitar solo for on Wu-Tang somewhere. Yeah.
Are you sure?
I'm dead serious.
Are you sure you didn't dream about this?
I did.
No, I'm not saying that your dreams can't come true and that you can facilitate it. But
fact check me. This is real.
No. Oh, sure.
Oh, man. That's cool. So you got to meet Danny Harrison. Huh? That's awesome.
He liked my sparkly boots.
Cool.
You do have nice boots.
Yeah, there's lots of fun people that come through. And the great thing about having a radio station is then I'm like, have a seat. Let's do a drop. Let's talk for a minute. And then we're just archiving all of that.
What's that? Do you have a name of the show? Or do you, are you?
Well, it's called WGRL, uh-huh. Where Girl Radio Lives. And we're just kind of, we're building it from the ground up. So right now everything's just on a SoundCloud. And then we have little playlists. So depending on the project, it goes into a different place.
So you're producing?
Yeah.
And then are you also hosting a show? Or?
Well, we don't really have like live shows yet. We just kind of hang out during class in the Airstream, and then I spend the week editing it into something usable.
Oh, that's amazing.
But then the girls, like, we did a really, really fun piece with these two girls that I couldn't figure out what it was that they were excited about, because, you know, they love their sparkly book bags and their shoes and everything. And we got these two 12-year-olds to do a piece on slang, which was really awesome. And they just went through and they were like, yee! And talking, that's like, explaining. Yeah, they had explanations for everything. Talking about, like, they're really into YouTube videos, too.
Right.
It's cool for me to get an access to that kind of generation and musical taste. And then I came home one day, I had them all write up, like, their top 10 favorite songs. And I was like, Jack, can you download these songs? Like, oh yeah, this is what I play in the club. So like my 12-year-old students and full service DJs are kind of on the same page.
Oh my god, that's too amazing.
What we do is basically for 12-year-olds.
Wow.
Pretty much. Yeah, Jack gives me some street cred with the little girls. So they're like, you hang out with DJs?
Yeah, tell them you know this song and they'll think you're the coolest person.
Exactly.
Well, maybe we'll take a little break.
Ooh, can we introduce a new song for the break?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, this is super exciting. I'll do it quickly. So Odette and I, for the past year, have been working on an album together. I produced her album, all her songs. This is the first project she's done everything herself, so she's played with bands in the past and backing musicians. This project's called 222. She plays everything, so from violin to banjo to guitar to...
You grew up playing violin, is that
forks.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sound effects, everything. And it's a weird, experimental, trippy project that we just finished, and this is the first time we're playing any of it.
So excited.
So this is awesome. Main chorus exclusive.
Ooh.
I think we're going to play the first track, which is called Creek Time,
mm-hmm.
right? And there's also going to be a remix project. So the whole EP is her, and then there's a second EP with a bunch of club DJs that remixed all the songs. So
wouldn't it be great if one of your girls came up and said, oh, you got to see this new Creek Time.
Hopefully.
Yay.
So this is exciting, and it's a short song. But
I'm so honored that you guys would.
We're going to debut it here on the main course.
Thank you so much.
Yay.
All right. So I guess we'll be right back.
Chips on the table. name is Brandon Boy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Liz rules.
Liz rules.
That was awesome. That's such a great drop. Aaron went to go visit the girls at the girls prep school, and they recorded that drop for us. But it's really funny. It's edited because the original version was like, okay, now say we're students. We're students. Okay, now say at girls prep school. So we had to like edit all the instructions out.
Oh, wow.
So they just sounded like real smooth. Heritage Radio Network is a wordy drop. That's not like, you're listening to NPR.
Yeah.
You know, it's Heritage Radio Network.
Wait, what was it? HRN?
HRN is, that's the short for it, yeah. We've always gone with the full name, though.
Aw. Branding.
Aren't those girls
beautiful
so cute
song, though? Beautiful song.
Thank you.
Is that you playing banjo?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And violin. And then the gunshots were recorded. We were recording at our parents' country house, and there was somebody shooting guns across the street, and we just recorded it with a...
You have to do me a favor, and please remind me of this. You have to watch a movie called Benjamin Smoke. Mm. Have you heard of this? I don't remember his name. His name, all I know is his name was Benjamin. He was in this very famous kind of like, he was like a cross-dressing, like a methamphetamine addict who also had HIV.
Oh, all right.
And he was in this famous band called the Opal Fox Quartet. And they were kind of the super punk rock. There was this big thing where they caused a riot in like the West Village and, you know, cops came. But he was kind of on his last leg. He had AIDS. And I was actually living in Atlanta at the time. And so he kind of had this, you know, just like, it was like he wanted to just do one more band. So he got these couple of local musicians. One was a banjo player, a cello player, and a drummer. And they did. But this guy was like, even though nobody really knows him, he was like, you know, like best friends with like Patti Smith and Michael Stipe. So you know, Jim Cohen, the filmmaker. He did, like, the Fugazi documentary and the Ellie Smith video and does, like, you know, corrects music videos. So he's the guy that made the film. But, yeah, I think, yeah, when I heard your song, though, it kind of took me back to a time and place. But, yeah, it's great.
Nice.
Yeah, banjo, I think you'd really like it. It's just banjo, cello, and drums. But his voice, though, it's like Tom Waits times 50.
Tom Waits is on the top of my must-see before I die list. He's like, I've seen most of the musicians I want to see before I die. Yeah. Most. Yeah. Steely Dan is still on this list.
But I'm gonna get them. We're going to the Apollo to see D'Angelo.
Yeah. Wow.
And because Jack's such a hustler.
I still have not heard the album, but I heard just great
things.
It's
a nice soul album. I also have a great news update for you guys. The Heart Gently Weeps was the first single from 8 Diagrams by Wu-Tang, and it features Erykah Badu, John Frusciante, and Danny Harrison.
Wow, what a lineup.
I believed you.
I know, but I had to look it up for myself.
Really?
And who knew Erykah Badu and John Frusciante, too? I'm like, damn, I'm going to go listen to that as soon as I go home.
Have you seen Erykah Badu?
Oh, no, I haven't
She's
seen her.
She's on the list.
Yeah, I want to see her live, too.
I used to see Erykah Badu. Like, I can't tell you. I was in Atlanta like in 98, 99.
Wow, really? That's and like my dream.
If I told you who I saw on a daily basis, first of all, all of them. Not him so much, but definitely the Goody Mob on a day. Like, you know, at least twice a week I'd see the Goody Mob. Erykah Badu. Also, too, it was when Cat Power was like, you know, if you saw Cat Power, it was, I saw the guy Smoke, the band was called Smoke, the movie's called Benjamin Smoke, but Smoke, I saw Cat Power open up for Smoke at a strip club.
Whoa. She was a former employee of ours.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
At Two Boots?
Yeah.
Wow. Who else has worked at Two Boots?
Oh, lots and lots of people. Slimma.
Slimma's the band. The guy from Dive, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a little bit on the shit list right now, on the internet shit list. But we won't go there.
Fair enough.
Oh, yeah, lots of people. Lots of people
got
there.
Another fun fact about Odetta's family, I have to put this one out there. Steve Buscemi's first role was in her dad's, like, short film.
Really?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Wow.
Were your dad and your mom made it, or was it just...
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was like, it was a real neighborhood, a little town back then. And everybody knew each other, and my mom would walk her dog Fan with Steve, and then they made a movie that I actually need to see again called No Picnic, and it's like a total portrait of the neighborhood. So
wow.
We'll figure out a screening
Steve
for that.
Buscemi's
and yeah,
first,
he was
right?
in it. Louis Guzman, like all old friends.
Wow. That whole like Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah, basically.
Man, he is. I don't know him personally, but I know I have a few people that know him. And I just, he seems like the stories
Jim?
That I've heard. No, Steve Buscemi.
Yeah.
He just seems like the greatest guy ever.
I got to DJ at, they do a benefit for the Girls Club with Two Boots, a Mardi Gras thing. And last year was at La Paz en Rouge, and I got to DJ, and they honored Steve Buscemi.
He was the king
of Mardi Gras. So they like carried him in on the throne and everything.
There is a great organization called Friends of Fire Firefighters. Do you know this?
Well, I know that he's involved with firefighters.
It's my friend Nancy Carboni, and she kind of heads it up, and they bought this, you know, old firehouse, and they have like, you know, just like benefits for firefighters, like, you know, therapy, or they do
Wow.
brunches and benefits, you know, just kind of like for, you know, because I mean, especially talking about this now, not to, you know, be too up to date with the news, but, you know, that fire, like, can you imagine like being a firefighter? It's so scary. Like, even if you don't fight a fire for a week, it's like constantly thinking about, you know, it's just so dangerous. It's so stressful.
That was a
job.
7-alarm fire, right?
7-alarm. There was 275 I'm sure everybody knows already.
I know.
But there was a warehouse in North Williamsburg that, you know, was set on fire. And I mean, the numbers that freaked me out was, it was 275 firefighters. They were spraying water from the river over like 3 or 4 buildings, and on top of it, they were pumping 20,000 gallons of water per minute.
Yeah. Whoa.
Yeah, it's just insane.
That's really
Where
scary.
Is that supply coming from, though?
It was a warehouse, and it had like just tons of papers in it. So, you know, once those papers set on fire, they burn up quick and just smolder. So it took over 24 hours.
Did somebody set it, or it just combust?
They say that it's from a air conditioning cord, which it sounds more like put a parking lot.
Yeah.
Kind of. Well, you saw they had all those like old hospital records.
Yeah,
the debris were flying everywhere, and you could see.
Did it come over here? Any of the smoke?
Yeah. Last night when I was closing Momo at like 12:30, I could actually have that wet burning paper smell. Yeah.
I want to ask you about Momo. How long has Momo been here now?
4.5 years it's been open,
and then
it took me about a year to build it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you remember your favorite night at Momo? Is that possible? Is that a reasonable question?
My favorite night at Momo. Nobody's ever asked me that. My favorite night at Momo. Let's see. I don't know.
I mean, there are probably thousands to choose from.
Yeah, there's some.
I just know you've had legendary.
Actually, yeah. I mean, I had some very special people stop by Friday night. It was a very good friend of mine's birthday, and I think that was probably my favorite night ever at Momo. Yes.
Mine too.
I love you guys so much.
So special.
Man. It really is the best place, though. It's my last meal. That's what she says all the time, too.
Aww.
That would be
my last meal, and if I had to choose one thing to eat every day,
yeah,
spicy tuna hand roll. Could live off that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny story how the spicy tuna hand roll came about, because, you know, it's cooked tuna.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually got a shipment of tuna, and they sent too much. We were supposed to get, like, you know, 30 pounds, and they accidentally sent, like, 50 pounds or something. And so they you know, we said we can't have all this tuna, and they're like, oh, you spend so much money, so just keep it. So I told my sushi chef, William, I said, just do something crazy with it. So he literally took, like, fresh off the boat, sushi grade yellowfin tuna, and cooked it well done.
Whoa.
In the oven, like literally took like, you know, like maybe 5 pounds and then cooked it in the oven just well done. And, you know, I think maybe kind of like a little bit of, you know, olive oil or grapeseed oil or something, and then basically took Japanese mayonnaise and made like a tuna salad. We kind of did it almost as a joke, you know, like almost like a tuna salad sandwich, but in the form of a hand roll, which, you know, the hand rolls are like the little ice cream cones and the roasted seaweed. And people that night when we did it, people were literally ordering a second one. And so we actually just put it on the menu. But actually, it's neat, because to stay with the original recipe, we don't really ever have old tuna, because we just order enough to keep it fresh. But we do use fresh tuna. We don't use, like, it's not like we use the tuna from 2 days ago. We stay with the original recipe, which is using fresh tuna. Cooking sushi grade tuna. But
that's unreal, man.
Well, you know the thing with sushi grade tuna is You know, have you ever wondered about, like, okay, let's say you catch a yellowfin tuna. Mm-hmm. So it's the same. There's two yellowfin tunas swimming side by side. One boat catches one boat catches the other. Have you ever wondered why some yellowfin tuna is $21 a pound, and then there's the other stuff that you can get for $6 a pound or $7 a pound? It's the way that it's handled after it's caught.
Right, and so killed, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, and also too how it's frozen, because right. if you freeze it very slowly, do you know when you're at a really cheap sushi restaurant and you have a nice big fat piece of tuna and you can almost see it sweating,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you touch it and it almost salivates? That's because it was frozen improperly. So okay. you know, you have the water molecules and protein molecules, and if you freeze it really quickly, if you have like a $1 million freezer in your boat and you freeze it, the water and the protein freezes at the same time. But if you just put it in your freezer, the water freezes first. And okay. so then that breaks apart from the protein. So that's why, so when you thaw it out, the water melts. Is now water and the protein is protein. So that's why, you know, so so even when cooking it well done, it's going to taste different than if you, you know, you just use cheap tuna.
And what about the Ikejime stuff? How does that play? Like the, you know, how they kill it with the, like, they put a prod like through its spine or something, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, Dave, yeah. Dave's always talking about that on cooking
yeah.
issues.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I know about it, but I don't know enough about it to like.
They say it's like a really thin spike or something, and if you put it right through the spinal cord, then the fish like just dies immediately without yeah. any stress, and yeah. the muscles are kept.
Like, yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, or something like that.
That's about as much as I know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's awesome. I did find out the hard way about why you're supposed to gut a shark right away.
Why?
Well, because it actually, they don't have, I guess they don't have a urinary tract system, and they urinate through their skin.
Oh!
This is a true story. So, I caught a shark one time in Florida, and it was a small shark, and I didn't know this whole thing about, like, you know, gutting it right away, so I actually took it. I have this thing where whenever I go fishing in Florida, you know, I take it home, clean it, and then put it in my mom's freezer, and then actually bring it to New York, mm-hmm. you know, because it's kind of fun. Yeah. So I didn't know about the whole shark. I can't remember what kind of shark I killed. But anyways, I know there's certain sharks that are illegal to catch and certain ones that are, you know, you're allowed to catch. But anyways, it was a small shark. And so he brought back some of the fillets, and it was a New Year's Eve party, and we served it as sashimi, but it was like, oh, it's really good. And in retrospect, it was actually ammoniated. It actually tasted like ammonia. It's because I didn't clean it properly.
Oh, God. How often do you go fishing?
Man, in my mind, once a day.
Right.
But I would say probably a good year is, you know, I'm so busy now, so probably maybe 3 or 4 times a year.
Okay. What was the story you were telling us about being out with Thomas Keller?
What's that?
The story about being out with Thomas Keller.
Oh, well, it's a Quiute. I see, you know when you know, like, Pisquetti, and you're a little kid and you can't say, it's the Quiute Indians, but I'm saying Quiute.
Anyways, Quiute Indians?
Quiute, do you know it?
No, I don't.
Oh, Quiute, you know, the Quiute Indians? Yes. No, they're a tribe of Native Americans in northern Washington, and they're also made famous from, you know, the Twilight movies. I guess the werewolves in Twilight are the actual tribe. So, and it's funny because when I went up there, you know, I've ordered salmon from them before, so I was in Seattle, so I thought I should go meet them. So when you're going up there, there's literally a fork in the road, and there's actually a little town called Forks, which is also in the movie, in the books. But so anyways, long story short, I guess they're allowed to fish, you know, year round. There's mm-hmm. no season for them because they're Native Americans. And so the day that I was there, only one boat went out because it was a really rough season. Salmon weren't running. And so that one boat only caught 2 salmon. And so the guy actually said, you know, I could buy one of them. So he, you know, I bought one. And then there was kind of like a guy, like a white dude that deals with them, that is the mediator between me and the fish company. To them, because they only deal with certain people. So he was like, do you want both of them? I'm like, no, I'll just take the smaller one because I'm taking it back to New York. You know, he put it on dry ice and wrapped it for me. But then he was like, okay. So, and then he pointed to the other one, which was like 21 pounds. And then he called French Laundry and sold it to them for like $80 a pound.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That is incredible.
And it was, I mean, you know, you hear about how fish is handled and this and that and the other. The thing with salmon is, it was a special story of how I got the salmon, but when I brought it back, because it was just babied, it was just handed to me, it was right there, they cleaned it in front of me, wrapped it in front of me, and then I just very carefully brought it back to New York, and it was so good. You know, you try to like, you know, examine your mind and say, Do I think the salmon is so good because I actually went to Seattle and I brought it back? You know, because it's, you know, it's like catching your own fish. You know, it's always going to taste better because you caught it. But that being said, it was light years above any salmon I'd ever had.
Do you know immediately what you're going to do with a special piece like that when you get, like, when you're bringing it back to New York? Do you have any idea of what you're going to do with it, or you're just like,
I kind of try to focus on what I'm not going to do with it, which is just like rip the skin off with my hands and then just pick it up and just shove my fat face and then just start eating it. So I try to focus on what not to do.
Not doing that.
Yeah. Cook it well done and put mayonnaise on it and make a hand roll out of it.
That would be very real.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I mean, as far as the restaurant goes, it's kind of like, you know, it's an organic process now when we get, you know, a new ingredient. We kind of like talk about it.
It seems like you just get special things every once in a while.
We have our core menu, and then we just kind of play around. But sometimes, you know, obviously I'm not there all the time, and my guys are just great, so I just let them go for it. As far as home goes, I just get things and just do it on the fly. Yeah. You know? But
you must see a lot of special pieces of fish.
Yeah.
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 I see a lot of special pieces of meat, too, from Heritage. I love...
That is very true. We had a steak on Friday night that was pretty damn good.
Uh-oh, what was it from Heritage?
It was horrible.
It was the worst beef ever.
You served me a piece of steak sushi once.
Yes.
That was from Heritage. That was the Wagyu, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was unreal.
Yeah.
That was really good. Odetta is a pescatarian.
Because of you.
Because
basically.
She wasn't really eating fish even before.
Oh, that's right.
And my first time in, you just force-fed me octopus or something. That broke me. And now I could listen to you talk about all of this. That's what I love about going to MoMA, is I always learn something new. And your whole staff is so incredible. They're talking about the cut of the bluefin tuna and which farm it was raised on and exactly how
There's only one farm in the world.
Well, yeah, that's what you were saying.
Yeah, we've been getting the bluefin tuna for
a nice point to make, though, before the show wraps up. Like, because I've always thought, some people scoff at farmed fish. They're like, oh, I don't like that. Farmed fish isn't good. I need mine to be wild. But I mean, and you could probably speak more to this, but sometimes it's much better, the farmed product, right? Oh. And, like, can we somehow switch the way people think about that?
Well, I think, it's everything. There's, like, conspiracy theories, but then the people that are talking about the conspiracy also kind of pad the truth to get you to believe the conspiracy theory. So then, like, who's right and who's wrong? So, I was researching like farm raised salmon, and I know there's some really horrible farm raised salmon, but there's also like in Scotland they have, you know, like these certified organic farms, and they have a certain, you know, square meter per fish, and they have, you know, and you know, like there was this one thing I think there is good farm raised fish.
Of course, it's like, and people get excited when a piece of meat on the menu says what farm it's from in parentheses, and like, why can't we get excited if it's from like the best farm fish operation?
Yeah.
And then say, oh, that, you know, why can't the fisheries get recognition like the farms do?
Well, I think that that's going to be the future. I mean, you know, it has to be.
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that true? Like,
yeah.
we do have to move into more farmed fish, right?
Yeah, obviously, you know.
Yeah. Well, the farmed fish I had at MoMA was damn good.
Yeah. But you know, that also, too, that's a special. It's in Osaka, and it's the Kindai University, and it's basically, I think, the only place that's doing farm-raised bluefin tuna. But it's like, you know, it's not like these, you know, these giant tunas, you know, locked into a, you know,
shipping container.
Yeah. Yeah. There's 8 bluefin tuna in this room, you know. No, but it's, you know, it's like they have this giant, like, you know, 2-mile net or something, and, you know, and they run them. They actually feed them live fish, and so they develop the, you know, the muscle mass and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
And I actually met the guy. I'm skipping out on his name. I'm sorry, but I actually, the guy that, that is written, doing the whole program, he's an American guy. And oddly enough, he actually used to make fish food, used to make organic fish food. Wow. And then he slowly got interested in the idea of farm raising fish. And so he just went big and started wanting to. So now I think, if I'm not mistaken, he's actually doing a second one in Panama. He's going to do big eye tuna in Panama. So
what is fish food? Make fish food.
Flakes.
Yeah, right?
Flakes of fish.
That'd be a cool interview.
Yeah. Fish food.
How's fish food made?
Yeah,
you have
right?
Don't you have a pet food show on Heritage?
It's true. We do have a pet show. Animal Instinct. What up, Celia?
Oh, there's really a pet show?
There's a pet show, yeah.
Oh,
it's great. She has pet psychics on, too.
Really?
Pet fashion people, like women that like dress up dogs in little like dresses and stuff like that.
Wow.
Bikinis.
Raincoats.
Yeah. The pet psychic was awesome. Liz knows what I'm talking about. Animal Instinct is a crazy show. It's awesome.
Wow.
Celia Cutcher is great. There's a lot of great shows on this network.
There's a lot of great shows. I prefer the main course. I think that's the best one, probably.
The best and first.
Well, thank you guys so very, very much. We are going to wrap up here, and then we're going to go get into a Subaru and drive to Gowanus and go try, I think, 35 soups.
What a horrible way to spend Sunday.
Yeah.
Trying lots of delicious soups.
Well, thank you so much, Odetta.
Thank you
can
so
you,
much.
Can you, what, the name of the band and the album again that's going to be coming out soon?
Well, just my name, Odetta Hartman. Mm-hmm. But Jack and I need to figure out what our next project is going to be called. Because it started out as a solo record, and then by the end, it's a duo record, really.
I don't know about that.
So we need to come up with something funny, and if you have any ideas, let us know.
You can Google Odetta Hartman, O-D-E-T-T-A Hartman, and you'll find her old music, and be on the lookout. This new project, 222, will probably find its way out into the world somewhere around February 22nd, which has to be, it happens to be 222.
Before I forget, we have to talk about Zach DeFloris.
Yeah. Wow.
My girlfriend, Jordan Haddadi, was given a mixtape by a gentleman 10 years ago that had Godspeed You Black Emperor on it, and I guess it was her boyfriend, and that was 10 years ago, and we got to the end of the, we found this out because you were friends with him, is that correct?
He was the last guest on Full Service Radio by chance. Yes.
Wow.
He goes by SPF 666 now, and he had a great interview about the queer community and dance music and
vegan
food.
Love the queers. Love vegan food.
These are all good things.
I love this guy.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Full Service Radio is also... I'll do a quick plug for my show, Full Service Radio, which is every Thursday, 7:30 p.m. on Heritage Radio Network, and I have all kinds of DJs every week playing music, talking about food, and then that show is followed by Gunwash, which Odetta produces, which Phil has been a guest on.
Best show ever.
One of the best shows.
And also, too, Zach DeFloris' ex-girlfriend, my current girlfriend, Jordan Haddadi, was a guest on.
That's right. She told some really awesome stories, actually. So,
yeah. What was the thing that Aaron freaked out about? The white owl? Do you remember that?
Oh,
what was
God,
that?
I forget.
There was some crazy white owl.
He's always freaking out.
Yeah. He's a freak out kind of guy.
I talk about that show all the time. We were just talking about it last night because our friend Chaka was over and he has a brand new baby. And you told me something about breast milk that I had never heard of before. And the saliva can
communicate with the nipple. That each time the baby breastfeeds, it releases a different type of milk with different antibiotics or fats
nutrients,
or something.
Yeah.
The body's incredible.
You're a genius.
Your body is a wonderland.
Well, thanks for having us, Phil.
You know, that's Alexa's pet peeve. We were going through pet peeve. That John Mayer is her pet peeve.
That's a fair pet peeve. Hey, shout out to Alexis.
Alexis, awesome. I hope she got out of Alcatraz.
Yeah, I hope
oh, and it's her birthday, too?
Is it really?
I think,
birthday, Alexis.
Happy birthday, Alexis. I think it was Thursday or Friday.
Good
or Friday
weekend.
Was.
Wow. Yeah. Oh, birthday buds. And thank you, Liz. Liz Smith in the engineering booth, who's doing
best
an awesome
engineering
job.
Ever.
That's right.
No offense, Jack.
She's the best at HRN. It's true. So, yeah, thanks. And thanks to Patrick for starting this whole damn thing.
Absolutely. All right. Well, have a happy Super Bowl if you're into that kind
Let's
of thing.
Go have some soup.
All right. Yeah. Bye.
Song for the main course is I Never Had by Breedlove and Chufu.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.